Good morning. My name is Brzezinski. Welcome to CSIS. I also want to thank the Konrad Adenauer Foundation for co-sponsoring this meeting. It is devoted to a discussion of Ukraine and its relations with the outside world, and notably the West. I just want to tell you that last year, CSIS released a report entitled Ukraine, a Net Assessment of 16 Years of Independence, as part of a project co-chaired by Volker Ruhe, myself, and also a group of former senior officials, both of the United States and of the EU countries. The report analyzed the progress that Ukraine had made over the last 16 years, but it also addressed areas in which Ukrainian efforts had fallen short. The report concluded with a series of recommendations for action by the Ukrainian government, but also by the United States and by the European Union. And this set of recommendations include a variety of steps to advance the cause of Ukraine's consolidation of its independence and its participation in the larger European community. And today, we're releasing a final report on how well Ukraine, the U.S. government, and the European Union have responded to the challenges identified in that report in advancing the objective of making Ukraine an increasingly successful European state. Volker Ruhe, the co-chairman, will now say a few words about these issues in general. I'll follow up very briefly, and after that, there will be an opportunity to raise questions and address them, particularly to the people who were very active in drafting this report, in visiting Ukraine and discussing the various issues pertinent to their concerns, and who are professionally more competent than either Volker Ruhe or I to discuss some of the issues raised in the report. Janusz Bugajski, right here, focused particularly on Ukraine's relations with the West. Steve Pfeiffer, at the other end, focused on political and economic reform. Keith Smith, next to Ambassador Pfeiffer at the end, focused on the economy, and particularly energy. And Celeste Wallander focused on Ukrainian relations with Russia. So when you wish to raise specific issues pertaining to what's in the report and to the dilemmas that it addresses, please direct them to them. And each of them will have very briefly something to say before we start the open session. So without further ado, let me invite Volker Ruhe, the former defense minister of the Federal Republic of Germany, to say a few words.
Thank you. I would like to start by thanking CSIS for doing this work, of course, together with the Adenauer Foundation. But it shows, I think, the strength of the political culture, the think tank culture in the United States, that such a report is being developed here and not in Berlin, not in Paris, and not in London. We don't have these kind of think tanks to do this kind of work. And so thank you very much for this effort. And it was really exciting to be part of the team here. And it also shows a very good cooperation between Europeans. I mean, we had, of course, the late Geremek and others from Europe who were working on this issue, a very good cooperation between the two sides of the Atlantic. The second point, the marks for the political elites in the Ukraine are not good, of course, in the light of what has been done in the past year and before, and I believe some of us may have been too optimistic after the Maidan that within a few years Ukraine, I mean, would grow into a Western European type of democracy. Obviously, it takes longer, but it is very important not to give up in spite of whatever bizarre also sometimes happens in the Ukraine, because I believe that the Europeanization of Ukraine is the key to the stability of a wider Europe. And I'm very optimistic that on both sides of the Atlantic, this is understood. I would also like to say that once a principal decision was taken in NATO that Ukraine, if it meets the qualifications, has the perspective of membership, I think it is now to the Europeans to open up the European Union more vis-a-vis the Ukraine. I mean, I would like to hear that, of course, one day they have a chance to become a member also of the European Union, but in the meantime, of course, step by step, free trade agreement, association, etc., has to be taken. But when we look at the 90s, this interaction between perspective of NATO membership and EU membership was very important for the countries of Central and Eastern Europe to have a real transformation of society. This cannot be done exclusively with a perspective of NATO membership. Third point, of course, the energy situation is very important. And there's one very revolutionary point in here, and I say this because I mentioned it 2 years ago, and Keith was a little hesitant to go in, to go into this. But from my point of view, it is very important, and it says, I should read it, it goes for that Ukraine should privatize its remaining energy assets through open tenders. Competition should be limited to firms and countries that abide by the European Energy Charter or that have open, transparent domestic energy markets. I've talked to leaders in the Ukraine also in the past and say it doesn't give you any extra security that you own the pipelines that go through the Ukraine. It makes much more sense if these pipelines would be modernized and would be owned by private, of course, respectable private companies from the EU, from the Ukraine, maybe also from Russia, if they fit into this spectrum here. And that gives you much more security also that the gas will go through there than when you own this pipeline, as you can already see in this situation. This will not be liked at first glance by the Ukrainians, but I think it is a very important point. Last point, I know the young generation in the Ukraine quite a bit from many travels, also in eastern Ukraine, Kharkiv, Russian-speaking. There are 100,000 students along. And my impression is that they are looking to the European Union. They are fascinated by the way people live in the European Union. And so what is important is to give more scholarships and more freedom to move also in the visa area, especially for students of the Ukraine, all parts of the Ukraine. There are some programs, they come to Poland. There should be many more programs to invite them into Western Europe and into the United States. And it's a different situation, but my age allows me to still remember the 50s and the 60s. And those that studied there, including myself, the one thing we wanted to do was to come to the United States and study here and work here and live here for some time. And many, many people in the political class and the leadership that developed in Germany in the 60s, 70s, 80s, even now, they have had this experience and has been an integral part of their life. And so I think it is of vital importance if you want to develop new political class in the Ukraine, and you have to do this when you see what's going right now. We need to support these programs more, have more of these scholarships, and have also think more in medium and long-term views and not what does the government next week or next month or next year. Again, Ukraine is the key to the stabilization of a wider Europe in the 21st century, And that is why it deserves the strategic interest, both of the Europeans and the United States. And this has been mirrored very well in the work of the CSIS. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Volker. And thank you, above all else, for your very active participation and for the sense of leadership that you infused into this undertaking. Let me merely add to what Volker said the following. This report updates the previous report, and it comments on the recommendations that were made to the parties concerned. By and large, we have to note in this report, and we do, that the responses have not been adequate. They have not been adequate on the part of the United States government, of the European Union, and of the Ukrainian government. Neither the United States nor Europe have been able to fashion a clearly defined, historically relevant sense of direction for dealing with Ukraine. There are ambiguities, there are uncertainties, and there are some divisions. Nonetheless, there is still a fundamental complementarity between the United States and Europe, in that the United States puts somewhat more emphasis on the security aspect, and that is, of course, symbolized by the NATO issue, and then by some direct bilateral arrangements that have been made between the United States and Ukraine, such as the recent security charter signed by the United States and Ukraine. And the Europeans put more emphasis on the role of the EU and of Ukraine's increasing association with the EU. In a sense, there is, one might say, a kind of unintentional and sometimes somewhat messy synergy between these two approaches. But they don't lend themselves to as a clear-cut and rapid crystallization as we would have hoped. Secondly, the report did make a number of recommendations to the Ukrainian side, and we have to note with regret that most of them were not met. And if they had been met, it would have been to Ukraine's advantage. And the reason for that is largely rooted in the leadership paralysis in Ukraine, the division among the top leaders, the focus on short-term political objectives at the cost of longer-range national interests. And that is a fact of life which we have to register and which is regrettable and which is damaging to Ukrainian prospects. Nonetheless, as Volker has just said, one does see on the horizon the emergence of a new generation of Ukrainian leaders, and one anticipates that before too long that generation will come to power. And it is backed by something perhaps even more important, the consolidation of a sense of national identity in Ukraine as a whole. There's been too much emphasis put in the West, and particularly in the United States, but I think in Europe too, on the so-called dividing line within Ukraine, the so-called Russian East and the pro-Western West. That is increasingly a fiction, and we see that even in the electoral results, that they're not compatible with that simplistic notion. Moreover, not every Ukrainian who speaks Russian is a Russian, just as not every Belgian who speaks French is French, or any Swiss who speaks German is German. There are a number of countries where are bilingual or multilingual and which national identity is not linguistically defined. In my travels in eastern Ukraine, I was struck by the fact that most people, after a few formal words in Ukrainian, would shift to Russian. But when it comes to talking about what they own, what they want to achieve, what is important to them, they were looking to Kiev. They weren't looking to Moscow. And even to put it on the crudest level of self-serving oligarchs who want to enrich themselves, their view is Ukraine is their opportunity to enrich themselves. It is not Russia's opportunity for Russians to enrich themselves. So there is a sense of statehood now that's quite strong, and it's becoming stronger, particularly among young people. Related to that is the recovery of historical memory. A nation identifies itself in part by what it remembers or thinks it remembers, because history is always a creative process and sometimes it's even an invention. Nonetheless, it defines the subjective relationship to this mystical entity which is the nation. Ukraine is recovering its historical memory. And for example, the issue of the Holodomor, the massive starvation that was imposed upon Ukraine in the 30s, and which resulted in the death of millions of Ukrainians, has now become a part of living member of Ukraine. And that is very important as well. I think we also have to note one more fact. For all of the current travails that Ukraine faces, in part because of a squabbling leadership, in part because of the financial economic crisis, in part because of the difficulties of overcoming the legacies of the past, Ukraine is and remains a democracy. And if you look at the former Soviet Union and cut away the Baltic countries, which were never a legal part of the Soviet Union from the standpoint of the international conception of the Soviet Union, Ukraine is the most democratic of the former component parts of the Soviet Union, far more democratic than Russia. And that has something to do with political culture. And that has something to do, in turn, with Ukraine becoming increasingly an integral part of the European family and not a prospective member of some exclusive sphere of privileged interests. So that is the context in which one has to evaluate also the shortcomings, the inadequacies, the need for more effective action that this report addresses. Now, let me turn to the four people who really did most of the work here and ask them to say a couple of words. Steve Pfeiffer, political and economic issues.
Well, in the original report a year ago in February of 2008, we tried to define certain political and economic reforms that Ukraine could implement that were both urgent but also doable, in the sense that we thought Ukraine had about 18 months from February 2008 until the end of this summer before it got bogged down in the campaign for the presidential election. But unfortunately, on those reforms, very little was accomplished. And I think the main reasons already been mentioned a couple of times, the political turmoil in Kyiv, and particularly disunity between the presidential secretariat and the cabinet of ministers. And one only goes back to the time last year when the cabinet and the president worked together to get through the measures that were required for the WTO accession, which they did successfully, to think what could have been done on a much broader agenda. And unfortunately, I think when you look at the last year in terms of political and economic reform, it's been largely a year of missed opportunities.
And Keith Smith, energy.
Well, if you look at the energy scene in Ukraine, it's a country that probably, if with the right reforms, within 7 years could be 50% self-sufficient in energy. And this would have a tremendous political repercussions in the country and with its relationship with the suppliers, with Russia and Central Asia. Unfortunately, there have been only small and incremental improvements to the energy scene, some on energy efficiency, some measures have been taken. But the major recommendations within that we made a year ago, whether it's privatization, pricing, you know, trying to price the energy at the real cost, and encourage foreign investment, those things have not been fulfilled. Now, the crisis between Russia, Ukraine, and Europe this January, went into February, dealing with the gas pipelines and the gas supply, in some ways has, I think, turned into a positive thing. First of all, there's been the elimination, at least appears to be the elimination of middlemen who were not unnecessary and who probably increased the costs and certainly decreased the transparency of the whole venture. And that's been taken care of to some extent. The second thing is, I think both countries realize that they took a public relations hit in Europe with the relations with the squabble on gas. So I think there is an increased tendency both in Moscow and Kyiv to try to work out some solutions. Unfortunately, the police raid on the gas company in Ukraine, I think, set Ukraine's reputation back a little bit, and hopefully they can recover from that. But I think that there's been some progress with Ukraine paying world prices, or what's called world prices, nobody knows what that really is, there's less likely that they have to give in to certain kinds of political pressures. The last thing I would say, though, which is a big disappointment to me, and I think a big disappointment for the friends of Ukraine in the West, is there's been absolutely no positive steps in trying to attract and keep Western investors in the energy scene. And I think that's important. Ukraine is a country with enormous potential, and yet it's the least energy efficient country in Europe and one of the least efficient in Europe, in the world. And yet they do almost everything they can in the country to discourage good Western investors from coming in and developing gas and oil and coal bed methane and wind power and everything else, partly because this idea of if the foreigners come in and make money in the energy side, it's going to be a loss for Ukraine. And that's the old Soviet mentality, and it's still, I'm afraid, in the energy scene, when it comes to foreign investments, it's still the case. But there are some things that are positive, but I think that's been a big negative. Super.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The net assessment of last year assessed where, in particular, Ukraine had made progress, substantial progress, over its 16 years of independence in establishing the fundamental basis for positive relations with the Russian Federation, noting that a lot of concerns of the early 1990s about Ukraine being able to establish its sovereignty, independence, and the legal international basis for resolving political, economic, and other contentious issues with the Russian Federation had actually been well managed and was on a very positive note a year ago. The assessment report of this year, unfortunately, has to acknowledge that many of those achievements are not certainly reversed, but need to be paid attention to because of the turn in particular in Russian foreign policy and Russian relations in its neighborhood, and that unlike a year ago, the kinds of issues that looked like they were settled, such as the meaning of sovereignty, independence, territorial integrity, citizenship, contract law, international law, and commitments under obligations such as the UN Charter and the Helsinki Final Act, have been brought into question, most clearly by the Russian invasion of Georgia, but also a series of other Russian initiatives in the region. So the assessment points out that that Ukraine needs to pay attention to those fundamental bases with the goal of, again, or reinforcing the basis for cooperative, constructive relations with the Russian Federation to address the very real but manageable issues of trade, investment, person-to-person relations, and the larger questions of regional security in the area, which can only be resolved if there is a constructive Ukrainian-Russian relationship over the long run.
Thank you.
Yes.
Bukhaisky relations with the West.
Okay, thank you very much. In a nutshell, I'll be very brief. Since our report was issued, our conclusion clearly is that Ukraine has only achieved very limited progress in moving closer to Western institutions, specifically with regard to NATO and the European Union. And there seems to be a vicious circle involved here. EU and NATO reluctance to admit Ukraine is reinforced by political division and lack of consensus amongst the Ukrainian leadership on accession, particularly with regard to NATO, whereas, on the other hand, the lack of Western unity on enlargement in turn further weakens Ukrainian government consensus. And I think, as Volker spelled out a little bit earlier, much needed, I think, is a new impetus, particularly from the European Union, to provide much firmer membership prospects for Ukraine, something similar along the lines of what the West Balkan countries have, but beginning also with a free trade agreement with the European Union, which is still a work in progress and hopefully will be finalized by the end of this year. With regard to NATO, obviously the door needs to remain open. I think our new administration has signaled this. But the Ukrainian government and its leaders have to walk through it together. And clearly they're not prepared at this point to do that. But the door has to stay open, and there has to be a vision, I think, both on the security side and the economic side for Ukraine.
Celeste Julian on APFC Energy. I was curious how you see the Crimea issue and how that can get resolved in a way that's favorable to both Ukraine and Russia.
This is another example of an area where clarity about the terms of sovereignty, territorial integrity, and international law is important for establishing a stable basis for resolving any disagreements or issues that may arise. I assume you're talking about, in particular, the 2017 date for withdrawal of the Black Sea Fleet from Crimea, from Sevastopol. The Russian government has certainly is facing a difficult challenge in withdrawing the force. It's a substantial military force. Current naval installations on the Black Sea on Russian territory are not well suited to receive the movement of the Black Sea Fleet. And so there's a reasonable set of questions about developing the process for the withdrawal. But reinforcing, it's nonetheless the case that there is an agreement, an existing international agreement to which Russia has committed itself and the Ukrainian government has committed itself. So reinforcing that existing agreement and signaling a willingness to constructively negotiate about the terms of fulfilling that agreement is something that the Ukrainian government has been paying attention to, and that perhaps the United States and European countries could play a constructive role in helping to support Ukraine and Russia to find a way to fulfill that obligation. So I think proceeding from the basis of the assumption that existing agreements have force and need to be fulfilled, rather than questioning the legal basis for previous commitments, is more likely to be a constructive way to support Ukraine and Russia in resolving any questions about this kind of issue in the Crimea, including, of course, issues of citizenship and language, then opening up the whole question of the basis for the establishment of Ukraine's sovereignty.
Just add a word to that. It's one of those issues which has very significant impact on internal Ukrainian politics. Territorial integrity, the issue of land, unites the Ukrainians very intensely. That happened already once over the Tuzla Island incident, in which all of a sudden all of the Ukrainians were unified by their fear that Tuzla was going to be separated from Ukraine. I think Yanukovych, who is the leader of the allegedly sort of more pro-Russian party, has damaged himself quite significantly by taking the public position that the independence of Ossetia and Abkhazia ought to be recognized. And as you know, it's only recognized right now by two countries in the world, by Russia and Nicaragua. Even the other post-Soviet regimes sympathetic to Russia have not recognized Ossetia and Abkhazia. Yanukovych jumped the gun, said it should be recognized. And that, in fact, could create a legal precedent for something similar in regards to Crimea. My guess is that he'll pay a political price for that, because one of the things that does unite the Ukrainians very much, in spite of linguistic or political divisions, is the sense of the land. It is a country which is still very close in terms of its identity to the notion of land, definition of territory. And anything that threatens Ukraine in that respect is going to unify the Ukrainians. And I hope that no one in Russia misunderstands that, because that could then create a really serious international problem.
Anders Åsland, Peterson Institute. Thank you very much for doing this. I have a question for Zbigniew Brzezinski and Volkeria. No country has been hit as badly by the international financial crisis as Ukraine. And the IMF now calls for a budget financing of $5 billion this year in order for them to get ahead with their program. Other international financial institutions can probably put up $3 billion of that. $2 billion is left. The natural position would be that the European Union takes $1 billion in credit and the United States another billion in credit. How do you personally look upon that suggestion?
You are more than I am. So I couldn't comment on the details. The IMF has been helpful, yes. I think what is very important is, I mean, that the Ukrainians get their act together, and the way they are fighting with each other is very un-European, to say the least. You know, the way they use the police or whatsoever against each other. But I couldn't comment on the details. I'm sorry.
Well, let me comment. I'm always willing to be rash. I'm very much in favor of the formula that the European Union provides $2 billion. Actually, more seriously.
Can you keep an argument?
There are signs that this crisis, however, is making the Ukrainian leadership work together. And that's encouraging. And there are some signs, I understand, from analyses of the situation, including by leading economists, that Ukraine may not be in as bad a situation as some other countries in the region. In fact, probably Ukraine is in a less critical situation than Hungary. So I think the Ukrainians will pull through, and the West should be responsive quite seriously. And while it's more of a European problem than an American problem, I think we and the Europeans should work on this together.
Don Jensen, Johns Hopkins University. I guess a question for either Steve or Celeste. Let's scroll forward for a year to look at the presidential elections. Could you talk a little bit about the effect of this kind of contentiousness on the trends you've described? And second, would it lead perhaps to a new administration more compliant with Moscow?
I think if you look at the polling numbers that you've seen now over the last 6 months, and you had to choose sort of the three likely candidates, the three most likely to get into the second round of the presidential election, because I would be extremely surprised were any candidate able to garner 50% in the first round, it would be Viktor Yanukovych, Yulia Tymoshenko, and a person who's emerged really in the last 5 months, Arseniy Yatsenyuk. Those are the only three politicians who seem to clear 10%. I think, based on, things that Mr. Yanukovych has said, for example, when he was prime minister back in 2006, he was the one that said, we do not want a membership action plan. In terms of Ukraine's geopolitical orientation, I'm not sure he would turn back to Moscow, but he would probably pursue a much more measured engagement with regards to NATO. Prime Minister Tymoshenko has been on record supporting Ukraine eventually moving into NATO, but as she said yesterday, there's two issues there. One is the reluctance on the part of the Europeans, but then she said also we have a problem within Ukraine, which is only 30% of Ukrainians today support Ukraine joining NATO. I'm not sure what that translates in terms of geopolitical orientation. But I think with all three candidates, or possible candidates, there's still 8 months, so something else could happen. What I do think there is probably, despite the differences over how fast, how far Ukraine should move with NATO, there probably is a fair degree of consensus among them on Ukraine should be moving towards Europe. And I think this is fairly general in terms of looking at the Regions Party, that the major business people in that party, they would like increasingly to be European business people as opposed to just Ukrainian business people, because that's where I think they see their economic futures. And that's a good thing. I mean, I think that's going to encourage Ukraine to look more to the West. And that's one of the things that I think why the last year in the political infighting has been so unfortunate, because it's probably delayed Ukraine from moving as fast as it could be moving towards realizing that sort of European vision.
I would to add to that, I think that there is also, of Ukrainian foreign policy experts and analysts and those who advise the political leadership on these issues, I think there's an awareness that Ukraine's eventual economic, social, and cultural integration, in particular with Europe, is something that is, as Steve pointed out, a consensus issue, and also one that not only is less contentious in relations with Russia, but actually helps to support the longer-term objective of helping Russia to integrate into global and regional economic and social networks as well. And so that, since that seems to be an objective supported by a wide range of the political, across the political spectrum, and deeply in Ukrainian society, that is something that we needn't necessarily think in terms of the outcome of the Ukrainian election in terms of this sort of geopolitical choice. In this case, Ukraine actually can have its cake and eat it too. It can fulfill the longer-term objective for its own country and also do so in a way that helps to improve relations over the long run with Russia.
And I have two questions. The first question is to Dr. Wallander. What is the role, what will be the role in Ukraine, considering the U.S. hope to get Russia's support in negotiations with Iran? Is Ukraine present in this equation? And second question is to Dr. Smith. Is it a very good idea to privatize Ukrainian pipelines, considering that Russia and Gazprom are using energy for political weapons? Will it not create more vulnerability for Ukraine? Thank you.
Thank you, Christina. Christina is one of my students, I would say.
It's a setup.
No, because that was a tough question. We'll talk about this in class next week, Christina. I think that it's pretty clear that the basis on which the Obama administration is moving forward to talk with Russia about larger security and strategic issues is in the strategic and security realm. That at least from what we know publicly and what we've seen, the terms of the discussion, the idea that there would you can't have your cake and eat it too is not necessarily one that's been conceded as yet. That reaching out to talk about nuclear issues, about regional security with Iran, is something that the administration is interested in doing, but no one's casting it in terms of some kind of grand bargain where you trade off, this is what you're really asking, trade off other American security interests in the region, including relations with Russia's neighbors. And it seems to me also that what we understand from Dmitry Medvedev's answer to questions about such an idea of making progress on relations in cooperation between the United States and Russia on Iran is that the Russians aren't necessarily pressing for such a kind of give-and-take bargain anyway. So you don't need to offer something that the Russians aren't even demanding, let alone consider whether you would actually follow that. So, you know, the United States needs – one of the problems the United States has had in the past years is it hasn't had – an approach to the region that was strategic and long-term and integrated. And starting to pick and choose issues on which you're going to press and leave the others behind would be a continued failure on that count, it seems to me, rather than using the opportunity for resetting the relations with Russia. And the signs, I think, are pretty good that kind of less than grand bargain is not something that's in the offing.
Your question about the pipeline is a fair one, and it's one that's bothered me for a long time. I've been writing long for several years about the Russian use of energy as a political weapon, and they use it. It's very obvious, and they used it in the Baltic states, in Poland, Ukraine, recently in the Czech Republic. So it's a real issue, and I would not support Gazprom taking over the pipeline. I would not support a consortium taking over the pipeline in which Gazprom could in effect control it. And that's why I think private is, but at the same time, right now, Ukraine doesn't have the money to modernize the pipeline. And as long as there's this uncertainty that gas is going to be coming through that pipeline, there's going to be a movement within Europe, to support Russian efforts to build additional pipelines that would bypass Ukraine, for instance, the South Stream pipeline, the North Stream pipeline, to put Russian gas into the Nabucco pipeline. All of these would bypass Ukraine, is they're intended to bypass Ukraine. I think that's why I've come to the conclusion, somewhat reluctantly, that some sort of a consortium in which Ukraine's interests are guarded can be put together with the EBRD maybe directing this, with the EU having a hand in it, and with Gazprom having a minor share, the Ukrainians having a big share in this, but the Western partners would have to be Western partners that don't have a track record of really giving in to Gazprom. There's so many Western companies that, in fact, have very close ties to Gazprom, and Gazprom has specific has a leverage over them. So it would have. It's easier to talk about those who don't, the small number who are not. But at the same time, I think if the right contract is put together so that if one of the Western partners wants to sell its interest, they couldn't sell it to Russia, they would have to offer it to the Ukrainian government first. There are these kinds of things that would put together that would give more stability to the pipeline, bring investment in it so that you wouldn't need the South Stream pipelines and Nabucco pipeline even if you had a very good system. I support, for instance, the White Stream pipeline, which most people are not aware of, because I think it's more of a real alternative to bringing non-Russian gas into Europe than the Nabucco pipeline or the South Stream pipeline. But in any case, I think a kind of thing can be put together which would prevent Russia from having control of the pipeline, but have an interest in it. And that would give, I think, some feeling of more greater security and confidence in Ukraine within Western Europe.
David Kramer, formerly with the State Department. I think coming back to Don's question, if I can, and maybe to Steve, but also perhaps Janusz, for your sense on how the West would react. Different question, though, not who's up and who's down. How bad can this get, given the very personal nature of Ukrainian politics? What's the worst-case scenario? What impact could it have? And Janusz, what would be the reaction in the West to that kind of development?
Well, I think the first point I would make is that the Ukrainians seem to be very, very good at muddling through. And they also seem to have this sort of sixth sense about when they're really at the brink. I mean, they went up to the brink, I think, at the time of the Orange Revolution, and they drew back. They got very close to the brink, I think, in May of 2007, where you had a potential situation where security forces might have been going at each other. And they drew back, and that was probably then the incentive to sort of take a deep breath and then work out the political settlement that led to the pre-term elections in September of 2007. What I worry about is you can only go to the – sometime you may go to the brink, and you may slip over the edge. And I think Zbigniew was exactly right. I mean, one of the things that the Ukrainians have made a huge amount of progress in the last 17 years – is eroding that east-west divide that people saw as fairly sharp back in 1991. I think it's been really blurred in some very positive ways. But I worry that this year, the combination of the political turmoil of the last year, which I suspect is only going to continue at the same level or more intensely in the run-up to a presidential election, plus the pressures of a presidential election, plus the pressures of an economic crisis, are going to come together in some ways that if the Ukrainians aren't careful in how they handle internal tensions or how they handle issues with Moscow, they could find themselves in a crisis that, could spin out of control. I think the chances of those crises are low probability, but they're not impossible, and they would have high impact. One example might be, and again, if you got the tension stirred up about the geopolitical question, about NATO, the question of the Black Sea Fleet, here's a hypothetical. In May or June, demonstrators in Sevastopol celebrate the 226th anniversary of the founding of the city and the Black Sea Fleet's basing there. It's an anti-NATO demonstration. There's some type of a clash with Ukrainian security forces, which have been reinforced in Crimea in the last several years. And the next day, Moscow says, we need to protect ethnic Russians, and there's a decision to deploy naval infantry from the Black Sea Fleet into Sevastopol. Again, I think the chances of that happening are very small. But if that happens, it's going to be at the top of the inbox in the White House and in Berlin and in London. I mean, it's going to be potentially a huge crisis. So small probability that things will get very, very bad. What I'm hoping, though, is that sort of the innate sense of pragmatism and caution will keep things from approaching that point. And I think, though, as the United States and its European governments look at engaging Ukraine, one of the things they ought to be thinking about is, are there things that they can encourage to sort of minimize these frictions within Ukraine or between Kyiv and Moscow?
Because David asked me as well, maybe sure. I should just jump. Just very briefly, David, I agree with Steve. I don't think it's in anybody's interest for things to really spin out of control, but even for Russia, I think Russia has three plans for Ukraine. Plan A would be to keep Ukraine within the Russian orbit. Clearly, that's not possible with the leadership. Secondly, to keep Ukraine divided politically but not unstable. In other words, not divided territorially, administratively, and so forth. I think this is the policy now. Plan C, if all else fails, and there is a united leadership which is pro-Western, then I think they may push the button on Crimea, on Sevastopol. And that, of course, would create major problems, not only in Ukraine, but surrounding countries. I think increasingly the new NATO members would feel vulnerable to the spillover effect, if you like, of a potential turmoil and crisis in Ukraine. I don't think it will come to that. I personally think somehow the Ukrainian system will manage this turmoil, this instability, if you like. I don't see a disintegration of the country, at least not in the near future, because it's not in the interests of either Ukrainian leadership or nearby countries, including Russia.
There is, in a way, almost a fourth scenario in which something happens not because of malignant initiatives, let's say, by the Russians or by some imprudent Ukrainian action. Namely, a spontaneous situation develops. For example, there is a continuing economic crisis. People are dissatisfied. Demonstrations in Sevastopol, which then produce reactions among the more nationalist elements in Russia themselves. The mobs proclaim Sevastopol to be a Russian city. And then both the Ukrainian government and the Russian governments are, in a way, forced by circumstances to react, and then the situation escalates.
You say it's not engineered by Moscow?
Not engineered by Moscow, but simply spontaneous combustion facilitated by extremist views, like Lushkov, for example, in Moscow, who proclaims publicly that Sevastopol is Russian. In that sense, Sevastopol in 2009 could become the Danzig of 1939. That is to say, a city which is ambiguous in its definition and becomes the object of an international collision, which then escalates.
Can I just add? Since we've now put specifics to the scenario that I think everyone's got in the back of their mind, this is why I'm talking about the need to right now pay more attention in Europe and the United States to reinforcing the existing agreements, existing diplomatic opportunities for bringing Russia, to not allow this to fester between Russia and Ukraine, where issues such as sovereignty, citizenship, obligations are allowed to, the edges are allowed to become fuzzy, subject to interpretation, one could say manipulation, and keep it in the clear light of day. Keep the agreements in the clear light of day. Support negotiations, even multilateral negotiations if the parties would like to, on resolving issues about the terms for withdrawal, about any issues about the treatment of residents of Crimea, in order to avoid this kind of scenario, whatever its origin, from escalating to this kind of situation.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. The image I have in my mind as I listen to you, and I've had this image before, is of Europe as a game of, you know, a tug of war, and Ukraine as the rope, as we and Russia pull on the rope. And the breakup was mentioned. Sometimes in a tug of war, the rope breaks, and I take Celeste's point. Is that an apt image? And if that's the case, is there a way of redefining the game? Because I'm concerned about this if this goes on like that.
Well, no longer in politics. Well, I hope I understood that correctly. As I've said, I've also been quite a bit in eastern Ukraine, and I would agree very much that they all feel as Ukrainians, and I think all of them want to move in the direction of the European Union. And but I also believe that when you look at Western Russia, they are already influenced by the European Union as a direct neighbor, and it will happen even more. I mean, I've been in Kaliningrad, the former German town of Königsberg, and it is now surrounded by the European Union, but surrounded in the sense of the attractiveness of the European Union. And I've given a speech at the Kant University in Kaliningrad, famous German philosopher. They named the university after him. And then the director informed me about the students, and he said, none of our students goes to Russia. I was trying to be politically correct as a German. Said, "Well, this is Russia," and he said, "Come on, you know what I mean. They're all going to Poland, to Mazuria, and of course to Lithuania. And so, and you can also study this when you're in Tartu, in Estonia, and see the influence on Pskov in Russia. So I was always telling both the Russians and by the way, also the Estonians, who were worried about Russian minorities in the Baltic states, that one day, and I think it's happening already, the relatives of the Russians, minorities in Estonia and in Latvia, in the Petersburg area, they will ask their politicians, look, I mean, we are as intelligent as these guys, why don't we have the same kind of economic development in spite of the problems we have right now in the Baltic states? So I don't see this tug of war you've been saying. It's a question, who's more attractive than the other guy? And I also believe, and I still remember being in Moscow in the 80s and even in the 70s, and Helmut Schmidt saying Soviet Union is an upper volta with missiles. So the only modern thing, somebody yesterday here in Washington when I came said it's a Saudi Arabia with trees. But I remember an upper volta with missiles, which means it's the only thing modern about the Soviet Union was the missiles. And you're not a world power if the only thing modern about you is the missiles. I think this is understood by Putin and the Russian leadership. If they want to be stronger, they have to have a modern society, a modern economy, and also an attractive political system, which they don't have right now. Who wants to copy it? I don't know anybody. So this they can only get from a cooperation with Western Europe and the United States. And this is why I'm in favor of engaging. So I don't know if I give the answer to this question. I don't just see this tug of war. I think it's a competition who is more attractive. And for that, in spite of all our sufficiencies in the European Union, I think we are very well equipped. And this is a good competition. Who's more attractive? Who's more magnetic? And, of course, I mean, last thing I would like to say, people talk about the crisis of the European Union and how weak and diversified we are. The fact is there's a long queue of countries who want to become members still of this European Union. So if this is a crisis, what is a crisis? How would you call it when nobody wants to become a member of the European Union again? The real problem is that the European Union feels overwhelmed by the magnetism which it carries on these countries, and feels too many want to join them. So this is sometimes called soft power or smart power. I don't know what the European Union has. I think it's the real power, and I have in dealing with other powers like tanks and planes in my distant past as defense minister in Germany, but I think I do understand that it is a very real power, not just a soft power, when you have an attractive political system, when you have a modern society and modern technology. And here we still have very good cards, and this is the kind of competition, I mean, we should deal with and engage. And I would be very fascinated by this young student from the Ukraine. I would like to see thousands more coming here and just experiencing, I mean, the kind of transparency which we have in our political system in Western Europe and the United States.
Well, I think this is an excellent note on which to end. I think it reminds us of something very basic. Ukraine is a Ukrainian, is a European people. There is a European family called the EU, and I think that tells us something about the future. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you.